not all heroes wear capes, but they do blow the lid off of this joint, people, with a little thing called the Twitter files. Everybody help me in welcoming one of the leading journalists of the Twitter files, Matt Taibbi. Here is a little bit about Matt. He is a veteran journalist, 30 years in the biz, okay, has been at Rolling Stone, New York Times bestseller, award-winning independent journalist. Now, if you don't know what the Twitter files are, I just don't know how to help you in your soul, okay? But just in case, this has started back in December when Elon Musk took over Twitter and gave access to internal documents, emails to a handful of journalists that shed so much light. I've talked about it on Cancel Me Baby, on the inner working of suppression and censorship and information flow. And Matt has really become synonymous with that. And I have to tell you, Matt, I've interviewed Oprah. I've interviewed Michael Douglas, Chris Pratt, Lady Gaga. My viewers could probably hear it. I'm a little nervous to speak with you today because, for real, Matt, I do not tell a lie, because I have been following this story since the beginning. But further, I am someone who has been a ball buster in the mainstream media. I've worked for, you know, big pop culture outlets and was always pushing up against my editors and, you know, did social media. And so I feel like what you did is so groundbreaking. We've never seen anything like it, you know, peeling back the curtain of a huge media behemoth to really see what was going on, not to mention having Elon Musk, this, you know, one of the most powerful billionaires in the world, being your BFF and having your back. So with that being said, Matt Taibbi, welcome to Cancel Me Baby. Let's do it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
After all that, he's like, yep, I concur.
No.
What she said.
I'm impressed that you interviewed Chris Pratt. Anyway, go ahead.
I will say, I mean, if your ego's not too blown up, Matt, I have to say, you are one of my journalistic heroes, but I don't think anybody can dethrone my lesbian Jew queen, Barry Weiss.
Oh, no, yeah, no, I understand that.
Which is it may be like a uterus female identifying thing. You know what I mean? Like just that bond. So
I'm not going to interfere with that at all. I completely understand. Yeah.
So, Matt, talk to me. Like I said, right, you really, I feel like, are the face of the Twitter files, because you started the first thread on the Hunter Biden laptop story. So Elon Musk is retweeting this. All of your tweets, he has the popcorn emojis, the whole world is watching. You said what, there was like 470 million impressions?
It was like 130 million, something like that. Or, yeah.
Okay, yeah. Fake news on my end. But set the scene for me, Matt, of that very moment where you are about to tweet the first thread. Like, you know the world is watching. Do you have your coffee? Are you chilling at home? I know when I go to post something controversial, a video or a tweet, I'm like, so what was your state of mind? Paint the picture.
Well, I was right here, actually. What had happened was I had been in Toronto 2 days before. I had done a debate with Malcolm Gladwell and some other people. And I had found out just before that debate that he wanted to do this, that Twitter wanted to do this story. So I flew from Toronto overnight to San Francisco. Then the next day, spent all day in San Francisco looking through the files, picked out what I thought were the most newsworthy, and then flew back to New Jersey, basically drove as fast as I could to my house, started writing the thing. And, you know, it was high speed journalism because I had to get comments along the way and everything. And by about 5:30 or so, I guess we were ready. And I had no conception that there were going to be that many people tuning in, but it was wild watching the number.
Yeah.
Flip. Yeah.
And it's so thorough because you have detailed tweets. Like I said, you have emails and documents of these executives at Twitter making these decisions, per Trump, you know, getting suspended. And like I said, the Hunter Biden laptop story, you have COVID information that's convenient for the administration, you know, all these things. So did you plan all of these tweets out before? I imagine this was thorough. Are you kind of like, let's just do this, let her rip?
No, I mean, the first one we did, you know, I think we, there was some pressure to get that one out quickly because there had already been kind of an announcement that it was coming, and we wanted to just do a quick hit to get people interested in it. But we had no idea what was going to be in the rest of the documents. I mean, no clue at all. And so it was kind of like archaeology. I mean, if you've ever talked to, you know, an attorney who does like a big civil litigation, they get a truckload of files. They have no idea what's going to be inside there. Mm. So they don't know what story they're going to be telling ultimately. And that was what our situation was. We had no idea what was going to be.
That's wild. In this
stuff. Yeah.
Well, I had my popcorn. I was watching every minute because obviously this is something that I'm very passionate about, free speech. And sure. And obviously given the name of my show, right? But what was so fascinating to me, and still, right? Like I said, I did my extra homework for you, Matt, is even still how the media, I'm talking, you know, Washington Post, Rolling Stone, your alma mater, like all of the New York Times pulled every stop to discredit what was going on, right? It was like, there's nothing to be seen here. This is actually just like having the backs of what they had seen. Like, this is executives making tough decisions. Like, there's nothing to see. This is conspiracy theories. This is for right-wing lunatics. You know, you had testified right in Congress and they called you a so-called journalist. Right, so right. How did all of this feel?
Well, I expected all that stupidity at the beginning. You know, having worked in that world, as I guess, you know, you know the same situation.
Yes, sir. We're going to get into it.
The media business is pretty crooked. You know, I had a good experience relatively at Rolling Stone. I think I had very good editors there. They gave me a lot of room to do a lot of cool things. But generally speaking, if you do things that are counter-narrative, you get a reputation for being a troublemaker, and you will run into difficulty. You'll just mysteriously not be able to publish things. People will be canceling lunches. Like, it's subtle, but you get the message, and before you know it, you're not working anymore. I mean, look at people like Seymour Hersh, or, you know, Chris Hedges, right? They were big stars in the business, and they get a reputation for being difficult, and they're out. And that's kind of how it works. So with this story, I knew that the people in the business were going to say at first that they hated it and there was nothing in there. But I guess a little naively, I thought when we found the stuff about the FBI and the CIA and the DHS talking to these companies that somebody would pick it up, and they didn't, you know. So that was kind of eye-opening.
Well, bit. First of all, everything that you said, and we're going to dive into this, I love our commonality. You know, you at Rolling Stone and me at all these outlets as well, but you are just preaching the gospel. I'm like, loud or that, because me, you know, getting turned down by, you know, editors. Obviously, my background is more in the entertainment pop culture space. So people wanting to take my firstborn child that is not yet here for, you know, asking certain questions on the red carpet or what have you, or pushing up against that narrative. So, sure. You know, you are speaking the truth, my friend. But what would you say? You know, I know you've been talking about this, you've been asked about this a ton, so I do want to go somewhere different. But overall, kind of a bird's eye view, the most surprising takeaway from diving into all these stories, and again, seeing from the inside how it affected our dialogue, right? Our communication.
I think it was just the sheer scale of the communication between the government, and not just one part of the government, you know, probably 12 or 13 different agencies are competing for this role of being like the chief censor in you know, in the American government. And so there's all these little different pockets of authority within the governmental structure. There's the White House that does their own communications. There's the Global Engagement Center at State. There's DHS, whose organization CISA, tried to create its own governance board. There's DARPA and the Pentagon, NSA, and they're all kind of sending moderation requests all over the place. And sometimes they come directly to the companies, and sometimes they come through middle these sort of NGOs and civil society groups. But we thought we would maybe find like two letters from the FBI, and instead we're seeing thousands and thousands of these requests, and they're coming from all over the place. So that was the thing that was the shock, was just the size of it.
And it's bad news because I've heard so many people argue, say for Twitter, right? The digital public square, but they'll argue, say with Trump getting kicked off. Who cares? He can just go talk elsewhere. You're not really being censored. No one's really putting, tape over your mouth. If they're a private company, if they want to take you off here, so be it. That's their choice. But what you've shed light on is obviously something much more deep-rooted and scary. We'll get into this more, but why it's not good for any of us. I think it's something more, it's much more telling than we'll just go talk somewhere else then, right?
I mean, there's a couple of things. Number one, the be, because of the tremendous concentration within the business, right? There's only like six or seven really, really big tech platforms. It's Facebook, Instagram, Google, Twitter, all of them. If you can get somebody taken off all of those and banned, they're really not going to be a major player in American society, or global society for that matter. And so, the ability to be able to impact just a few companies with essentially secret communication. And they did have regular meetings between the FBI, the DHS, and a handful of companies. That's very significant. That's pretty scary, especially since they had a very expansive definition of what they thought was bannable or reasons to de-amplify people far beyond what the law says, right? Like the law has a very, very high standard for the government getting involved in speech, but here it was very low, and that's what's scary.
Well, even you personally, not to get too much into this, but the IRS showing up at your door coincidentally, like Big Brother is coming for your ass to anybody who questions anything, period, right? But yeah, something,
Yeah, that was weird. I mean, I don't know if you, I mean, I spent a lot of time in Russia. I lived in Russia for 12 years. So during the 90s, and a lot of my friends were Russian reporters, and they were like hardcore investigative reporters who took very serious risks. They got beaten up. They got, one of my friends got hit in the head with a crowbar.
Oof.
A few of them, they weren't close friends, but a couple of them ended up getting murdered. So I'm always conscious
Oh
of being,
my gosh.
of complaining too much about this kind of thing in America because it's not nearly as bad.
That's true.
But it's
That's
they're
true.
definitely trying to send a message when the IRS shows up, I think, at your house. I mean, it certainly looks like that, and that's a very drastic step for them to take.
Also convenient because both sides love weaponizing First Amendment, and they leave out that First Amendment is also freedom of the press. So convenient, like where is that to be seen in the dialogue again when it's so selective? But another overlap that I thought was interesting that we have, Matt, I don't know why all roads seem to lead to and from Chrissy Teigen, right? But when you were testifying at the same time, there had been all of this hoopla around a Chrissy Teigen tweet in which she was critical of Trump. And really, it was kind of ammo for the left because what we discovered is how, even though all of this was much more slanted against the right, because of the executives and the people
America.
made up at a place like Twitter, but we saw how Trump's people almost called in a favor, right? Being like, take this tweet of Chrissy Teigen calling Trump a pussy ass bitch. It's derogatory of the president. Take it down, right? So all of this attention is going on while you're testifying. And I thought that it was so interesting because I don't know if you know this, but years back, I wrote a piece about Chrissy Teigen for VH1 in which I called out her cyberbullying. And it was of cancel culture before its time, Matt, because she basically pulled in a favor and, you know, went after me publicly on Twitter. And it was, like I said, a cancel culture moment before its time. VH1 suspended me. At a principal, I walked away from the company because I said what I said. Don't shut me up. And a turn of events years later, her cyberbullying scandal comes to light. And I wrote an op-ed in USA Today about it saying, you know, in light of all this and being on at the brunt of it and my personal experience, she still shouldn't get canceled. Let's learn from all this. Cancel culture goes round and round, right? But I just thought how interesting, because it's like the chain, you know, Trump and his people trying to shut up Chrissy Teigen, Chrissy Teigen trying to shut me up. And so, you know, what does all of this say about power?
Well, I think that story is very representative of what happens. People, when they're out of power, they suddenly become very, very, you know, ardent defenders of the First Amendment. When they're in power, they see it as their birthright to pick up the phone and call a buddy at a company and try to get, you know, a tweet taken down. But, you know, that just makes it, your story makes it even more ridiculous that they're trying to make Chrissy Teigen out to be a, you know, an avatar of the First Amendment or something like that. But that's right. That's not uncommon. You know, I mean, I think that's, you know, even Donald Trump, I would say, you know, there were instances where he tried to get people taken off Twitter, but, you know, he complained about his treatment as well. And so, you know, I don't think that's uncommon at all.
Well, it's so interesting what you said, because, you know, there was a funny line in a Substack of yours, which was like, you know, they seem to be more concerned over Chrissy Teigen than, you know, what I'm saying and what's going on here. And again, with power, with celebrity, you're right. It's like, okay, someone like a Chrissy Teigen is the crusader of the First Amendment. What's happening here? So it's a really interesting, I think, view of the intersectionality, right? Of pop culture, speech, social media, all of it.
Yeah, and the inability, that the thing that was frustrating for me about the Chrissy Teigen episode was the inability of people to grasp the scale of what we were talking about. So you have Donald Trump maybe asking to take one tweet down, and I'm talking about multiple gigantic federal agencies that are spending tens, in some cases, hundreds of millions of dollars just on this, on monitoring people on social media and trying to get people taken offline. Like, that's a much bigger effort over there. That's like much more dangerous than this thing, but they just made it into a distracting technique, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I feel like it's a Black Mirror episode, but our lives, like, what a time. So let's pivot a little bit, Matt, to, and when I had met you in person, we talked a little bit about this, but something that's fascinating about you and that I'd love to pick your brain on, again, where I share common ground, is your lengthy background at Rolling Stone, right? Mm-hmm. And that kind of crazy pivot. I mean, you look at a Rolling Stone, which is one of the most iconic, cutting edge, again, political, pop culture, Jan Wenner, really just pulling no punches and coming in like a bull in a china shop, you know, unlike anything we'd seen. And the reason I say I share common ground, aside from all of these kind of side stories, is the work I've done with Playboy. So very much synonymous, right? Again, at the time, Hugh Hefner, nothing like it. When women at the time are stepford wives, you know, housewives, it's like, here they are showing their bodies and sexual expression and also really smart articles. You have, again, unlike anything at the time, groundbreaking, Jimmy Carter, while he's running for president, doing a Playboy interview.
Yeah.
I did a Playboy spread that I pitched and spearheaded, celebrating all of this, really the idea of free expression. And I'm the only woman who was both featured in a single issue, both in a pictorial and in the masthead as a writer and contributor. Of all things, it was in the 65th anniversary issue about free expression, right? Wow. So my dream come true. And in my essay, Matt, I talk about, this was like 2018, 2019, but I talk about a lot of these things, how even at the time, editors of mine shutting down pitches I had because they were scared. It didn't fit their narrative. Watching all of this happen, people clamping down on others they didn't agree with. So same thing. It's like, who would have thought the Playboys and the Rolling Stones would now be the enforcers, would be the thought police personified? What the hell happened?
I don't know. That's an amazing story, though. Like that, that's a great accomplishment to have been the first person to have done that. That's a great thing. Yeah, no, I think both of those magazines were famous for the right reasons, right? They represented freedom and free expression, you know, a kind of boldness. You know, Playboy was. It was unorthodox and challenged authority in a different kind of way, but it always did great reporting. I mean, I think that's one of the things that people forget about it. I always wanted to write for Playboy. I think I did maybe one article for them once a long time ago. But you know, and Rolling Stone similarly, like they weren't selling sex. They were selling rock and roll, but they did tremendous, you know, really interesting, innovative journalism. They brought in writers like P.J. O'Rourke and Hunter Thompson, especially. And when I got there, they were still, I think, in their heyday. Like, the, you know, Jan was still, you know, relatively engaged with the process. And, you know, they let me do all kinds of crazy stuff. And it was, I had one of the iconic jobs in journalism, which is covering presidential campaigns for Rolling Stone. But even they eventually got swallowed up by a corporation, and now Rolling Stone is, I think, kind of unreadable. I mean, it's
oh my God,
impossible. And you know,
it's embarrassing. It's like, look at your legacy. Like, what are you doing?
Yeah, I don't know how you're going to appeal to young people and college students. Like, that was supposedly their audience, right? If you're worshiping authority constantly and taking the side of people in power, like I just don't understand that role in media. It's not a comfortable one that I think any journalist should be happy with.
So Matt, if you could shed a little bit of light, we can speak in this sort of general way, but for my listeners who are all about this and love this, they know some of my stories. Again, my background is more pop culture and entertainment. So when it comes to shutting down narratives, I have experience with pitching stories around Me Too, right? Being someone who was on the red carpet as it was unfolding. For an example, I pitched a story in which I interviewed R. Kelly survivors, and I used their quotes to encourage the cream of the crop A-listers to tell their stories and bring these guys down. Because if they don't, how the hell are the R. Kelly survivors, how are the little people, right, ever gonna have justice? And I just thought it was super virtue signally, and the black dresses and all this. And the whole idea is like, walk the walk, because it will actually in turn help this movement that you're preaching about, right? And it's so wild because I had editors ignore it. We can't, you know, this is a great piece, but you know, we can't run this, right? Because it would make the celebrities look bad, even though it would ultimately give voice to R. Kelly survivors and help the movement. So that's just an example. Could you give any specifics to my listeners about things where you started to see the tide turn, where you would pitch certain things or offer certain things and they were like, not today, buddy? You know, you talked about suddenly you're not invited to a meeting, convenient, you know?
Yeah. It's funny because I had done for almost 10 years, I did a lot of stuff on Wall Street after the 2008 crash.
Right.
Did a lot of investigative reporting about like why that happened. And a lot of it was not flattering to the Democratic Party. It was like, even though the people at Rolling Stone very much wanted to be in with, you know, the Obama administration, they really, really prized their relationship with you know, the president. Some of that reporting of mine didn't make him very happy. In fact, he criticized it kind of angrily in one of our interviews with him, but they still let me do it, which I thought was interesting. I mean, I was going after both sides. I didn't care, but after Trump got elected, everything changed.
Yeah.
And suddenly, you know,
So true.
the first thing that happened was I was supposed to do like a monthly reports on the Trump presidency, but I couldn't confirm a lot of the stuff about Russia, you know, the Russia story. And I was going back to my editor saying, like, this stuff doesn't add up. We don't have enough evidence to say, you know, that we can that this is something that's provable. And suddenly I got kind of unassigned from that project. And then later on, when I was doing my, you know, campaign coverage, they didn't want me covering Democrats anymore suddenly. So who knows exactly what that was about? You know, that maybe they had a genuine change of heart, but I think the Russia story was big for a lot of people in the business. A lot of traditional investigative reporters got moved out during that time because, you know, we don't really care who's guilty of what. We just go after whatever's true. And that story didn't add up for a lot of people, and a lot of them ended up without jobs. So.
But do here's my question. Because again, like you, I saw it from the inside, and we're going to ultimately get to this in the end. But these traditional outlets are dying off, and they keep pushing and peddling and doubling down no matter what. To what end? Where, you know what I mean? Do they see it,
That's a
or do
great
they just not
question.
care?
I think they're totally out of touch with audiences. And this is something that I first noticed during the Trump campaign, right? So the first time I covered a Trump event, I remember I was in a crowd, I think it was in New Hampshire, and the press is always they we always stand on a riser in the middle of the hall. We look, you know, like idiots, right? And Trump started to like a stand-up comic. He started to make fun of us, and the crowd loved it. They went nuts because reporters are symbols of privilege and of, you know, sort of Manhattan upper class cosmopolitan society, and they hated us. Trump figured out that that was popular, and he went with it. And I went home to my editors and I said, "This is gonna work. Like, whatever you think about Donald Trump, he's picking the right targets." And he's, you know, people out there are angry about all sorts of things, and he's in touch with it. And I think people just couldn't see that this was necessary to understand. The entire attitude of the business was Donald Trump is illegitimate. Whatever he's saying is wrong and bad, so therefore we don't have to pay attention to it. But that's why they don't have an audience now, because they're not in touch with what their audiences are thinking. I mean, people are furious. You know, there's been an enormous transfer of wealth in this country since 2008, from, you know, from the middle classes to the very rich, right? And there are a lot of people who used to have solid middle class lives who don't anymore, who are struggling, and they're furious. And I think a lot of people in media do not understand that because they don't talk to anybody outside their own
It's,
bubble.
you know, and you hit on this with, you know, Bill Maher talks about this. I talk about this often on my show. It's the turn of re the role reversal. It's like you would expect this from the traditionally, you know, uptight right who wants to shut you down and thinks everything is taboo. And the left are the ones all like, you know, you want to hold the people, you want to hold the man and the government accountable. You want transparency, you want to be free. And I say it all the time. It's like, what the hell happened? I mean, I know you say you talk about, you know, growing up liberal. So that real role reversal, I think, is so nuts. And further, with all of this being said, again, with what you did being smeared constantly for right-wing lunatics and pushing conspiracy theories and Elon Musk is a nutbag and all this, isn't it an issue that just should not be partisan? I mean, your FBI information, I think illustrates that, but shouldn't this not be a left-right partisan issue?
Yeah,
All of
I
it?
think a lot of these issues shouldn't be partisan. I mean, we just did a story this week about showing that some of the scientists who wrote a very influential paper about the origins of COVID, that they were pressured from the beginning to say that they didn't think there was any evidence of lab origin. And we're looking at their communications and showing that they all thought that there was evidence of lab origin. And I don't see how that's a left or right issue, except for the fact that Donald Trump said some things in that direction at one point. It's not left or right intrinsically. Like, I don't care where the virus came from. But it's just a matter of what's true or not, right?
I mean, well, my thing is, and I've said this from the beginning, and I said this during COVID, why can't we have the discussion? An authority figure in this, and they're shut down and taken off Twitter. Okay, shouldn't they be heard? They know more than we do. It's so wild. So in that vein, I know we're running out of time here, but I want to ask you about deplatforming, because while the Twitter files and the documents show, like we've said today, that it was very much more biased towards right-wing commentary and entities and people versus the left, it does happen on both sides, hence the Trump Chrissy Teigen thing, right? But what's problematic to me is the cherry picking. So even I love Elon Musk. Like, I'm all for an Elon moment. But I thought it was so interesting. It's like all these billions of dollars spent on Twitter, this whole endeavor to restore free speech. And then here we go. It's going to take off, journalists who are critical of him. Like, what just happened? Where is the lie? Hypocritical much? So what's the deal? The cherry picking is not my friend. Not any of our friends.
No, I mean, I obviously had a sort of a falling out with Elon myself, and my own account was de-amplified, and I had some stuff taken down off there.
Right.
Look, I think owners in general of these platforms, that they're incapable of not exercising the power to control, who gets seen and who doesn't. The temptation to meddle in that is just too great.
Yes.
And, power, somebody like Elon, there are a lot of things I like about him, but I think he takes things personally sometimes. And so that comes out in how they decide to de-amplify or de-platform people. And you can't think like that. I don't think the prior owner of Twitter, Jack Dorsey, he thought a lot about free speech. I mean, he cared a lot about it, but it's just the bureaucracy sort of overtook the company.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a feature of the system that it's very hard to prevent it from happening.
So with that being said, last kind of cap on this, again, I look at things through a pop culture lens. And I remember when Trump was taken off Twitter, Emily Ratajkowski said, if they can take him off, shut him up and off, they can do it to any of us. And she got blasted. And at the time I was like, she's right. So I'm a free speech advocate through and through. It's funny because I just did a whole episode on the Tucker Carlson, Andrew Tate interview. And I find Andrew Tate absolutely repulsive, misogynist. I don't think he should be deplatformed. We just be louder, right? So where do you see, because again, people will say the CCP, Taliban's on Twitter, where is the line of hate speech? Or is it, do you pull a Justice Hugo Black and it's like anything's fair game? Like it's the Wild West, how do you kind of draw that line?
Well, first of all, I think it's a great point. Like if you can take the president off Twitter, who is that person? Who gets to make that call? If there's somebody who's able to do that, then we're misunderstanding power in this country. Clearly the president is not the most powerful entity in the country anymore. I remember when they raided the office of Michael Cohen, Trump's lawyer. And, I have a friend he's like a black drug dealer. Wrote a book together once, and he called me up and he's like, man, if they can raid his office, what are they going to do with my lawyer's office? Right. I mean, like, and that's a good point.
Again, why it shouldn't be a left right issue, because guess what? The left is having their moment right now, but what happens when it comes right back around and they do it? Like, it just goes round and round and round. And again, if no one's safe, that should concern you. Period.
Right. And we saw in the Twitter files that, the authorities, maybe in America, they were more concerned about the right, but certainly in Europe, they were more worried about the Yellow Vest movement. In South America, they didn't like Maduro. In Venezuela, in Africa, there were leftist movements they were worried about. So, it's just a temporary thing in America that these authorities happen to be more focused on the right. the problem is that they're building the mechanism to do this.
Exactly.
And whoever gets to sit behind that chair is going to have awesome power. And we don't, our system is supposed to be designed to prevent exactly that from happening. And nobody is looking at that and wondering, what bad things could happen if we let this go on like that. So, yeah.
Well, listen, I have to start wrapping, Matt. Unfortunately, I could talk to you forever and a day, but I'm gonna end before we get to the big kahuna of the death of the legacy media. We know it well, given your background at Rolling Stone. I talk, obviously, I'm very passionate about this. I talk to a lot of comedians, actors, directors, particularly about the death of comedy. And that's where it feels really 1984, because it's like, okay, are we getting, I interviewed the creator of Old School, iconic, right? And he's like, yeah, some of those things, like, would it fly? That's where it feels Orwellian, because it's like, okay, are they going to choose what jokes are and aren't funny? I recently interviewed Josh Duhamel about his new movie that is so politically incorrect. It hits every taboo button, and it was so refreshing. And all of that goes to say, I believe what they're doing right now isn't us. That's why the Josh Duhamel thing, I was like, oh my God, someone in Woketopia, Hollywood thinks it. See, I'm not crazy. And it's not us what they're doing. It doesn't reflect how we really think. And so with that being said, right, seeing how these narratives are formed, seeing all of this go on, it's a little existential, but are we stuck? And how do we get out of this, these boxes and these narratives?
Well, I think, first of all, you're completely right. One of the things that's great about America is always been great about America is our sort of intrinsic willingness to say whatever the hell we want, and no one can tell us what to think. And I don't care
Period.
if you're a, the king of whatever, or the prince, a prince. Like, in America, you're no better than me. And that's the attitude that comedians in America have always had. It's this kind of bold, brash, screw you thing that's kind of unique to us. And it's why we've always pr produced great comedians, right? And I think they've always been leaders of movements when we're s stuck in moments like this, where there's political conformity and people can't have to find a way to break out somehow. Think about who helped us get out of that in the 50s, right? It was people like Lenny Bruce, then it was Richard Pryor, Woody Allen, right? Like, all of those comedians. I go back and I listen to, for instance, like Richard Pryor did a routine once about a Chinese waiter who stuttered, and it's so politically incorrect. It like you could never ever do that routine today,
So sad.
but it just, it's he went to a place where everybody kind of at the end of the day they laugh so hard that they kind of forget all the things they're uptight about. And that's what comedy is supposed to do. And
Yes.
you cannot have comedy if people are not allowed to miss. That's the problem. Like they've basically said, if you say something that's like, 5% too offensive, no, we're not going to allow that. And you can't write well, you can't do comedy, you can't do anything well if there's no margin for error. You have to have the room to experiment.
That's why I end on the note about comedy, because with journalism and with writers, they can try to clamp us and have their narratives. If you're gonna meddle and do this with comedy, we're really fucked. Because
Right.
to your point, you said it so well. They are the ones to look at all of the awkward dark spaces and shine a light and make us think and entertain and move us forward and evolve. So we're really screwed if that's, in question right now.
Absolutely. Yeah,
So very last thing for you, Matt. The death of the legacy media, like I said, I mean, it's permeated everywhere, whether it be, the Rolling Stones, the Playboys, they are flailing, even late night. Like, who watches late night besides my grandma from the grave, right?
Oh my
So
God, no,
what,
yeah, it's horrible.
oh, it's so bad. So the future of it.
I think legacy media either has to evolve or it's not going to really exist anymore. Right now, the only reason to really even read the Washington Post or the New York Times or turn on any of the major channels is to learn what Washington wants you to think. I guess that's important on some level. I mean, I actually studied in the Soviet Union. It's very similar to what how they did media. But nobody read the newspapers to be informed because there was nothing in the newspapers that meant anything. It was all fake. So people are going to get their news from somewhere else if they can't get it from those places. And those places are going to become the new authorities in media. And that process may take a while, but I just don't see. I mean, do you see it? Do you see CNN, MSNBC, NBC reforming? I just don't see them cluing in.
No, but to be, I think, obviously, I think about this a lot. And part of what worries me and inspires me, because obviously, people like you and I, we are fighting the good fight. We're not going to shut up. Obviously, these people are dying off, right? Like quicker than they can say Elon, quicker than they can say Kanye. But what does that mean then? So does it all go into the hands of, quote, this new like digital citizen journalist? So what does that mean? Again, how do we trust that? How, versus I don't know, maybe I'm being short-sighted, but versus, someone who's a tried and true journalist who's studied, who'd put in the work versus someone on the street going, "Hey guys," because that's where I see it going. A lot of it is that kind of citizen, every man, every day, quote, journalism. So is that the future? If so, what does that look like? What does that look like? If so, how do we trust that, right? How do we discern?
Well, we have a tradition in this country. I mean, another thing we have a good tradition of in America is investigative reporting. We've always done well with that. People like I.F. Stone, that was just a guy who worked in the in his basement. He made a newsletter with a homemade printing press and sent it out to America. And he was very influential, and he influenced the mainstream media with his reporting. I think we're going to have a model like that eventually. I mean, look at the sizes of the audiences. I mean, so many more people watch Joe Rogan than watch any show on cable. The audiences are just not there anymore. So they're going to have to go to some other place to get their information. The problem is monetizing things like, straight reporting. It's just hard to do. So we'll figure it out, but the real thing is, I think those companies need to realize that they're out of touch with their audiences, and hopefully they'll be greedy enough to try to get it back.
And that's where it does give me hope because the people are gonna come to the Matt Taibbis, they're gonna come to the Taylor Ferbers, and we're gonna blow this up. But that's where I am hopeful in that I do see an entertainment in all of it. It just has to come to a break. And I call me an optimist. I really do see a renaissance on the horizon. It's just a matter of how long does it take until that's eventually gonna break, right? And hopefully we see it
Totally
sooner
agree.
than later. I do have to let you go, Matt, but I also on a last note, I just want to say thank you. Something that really struck me is reminding us of how journalists in other countries are treated, and it really puts things in perspective. So I want to thank you for that because it really, it ignites my passion about this. And but also when I'm getting into rather sometimes that kind of pop culture stuff, it's like really put things in perspective of what's going on
Oh,
there. You
no, but
know,
that stuff is
frivolous, I guess,
important.
but.
And I was just trying to point out that, in some places, reporters have a pretty tough time, but so we should be thankful that being sued is, like usually the worst thing that happens to us.
Exactly. Not to be
So,
taken for
yeah.
granted. Our speech, our press, and let it ending on a patriotic note today, let it rain free while we're both
Exactly.
here. So, Matt, thank you so much. What a
Absolutely.
pleasure. I've been wanting to have you on for months.
Oh,
So,
thank you so much. Well, I'm very, very glad we finally got to do this.